A few years ago, citrus trees in Florida just started dying. A disease called citrus greening spread all over the state, wiping out thousands of acres and devastating farmers. The major culprit was a tiny bug called the Asian citrus psyllid that carried the disease from tree to tree. Well, that same bug recently started showing up here in California, where citrus is a $2 billion industry. Farmers are worried that what happened in Florida might happen again. So they're working with scientists to kill off the bug before it's too late. And the solution isn't necessarily pesticides. The answer to this problem may be another bug. Stephen Jackson has that story.
I'm getting the grand tour of Associates Insectary in Santa Paula, California. It's basically a bug farm.
I'll take you to where the wasps are being collected now, and the wasps are raised.
That's Brett Chandler. He's the owner. They raise beetles, snails, mites, and wasps. Bugs that do so many good things for farmers, they're called beneficials. In the wasp room, Chandler hands me a little cup, the kind you might get cream cheese in at a deli. This one is full of baby wasps, no bigger than grains of salt.
I'm guessing in this cup, by what I see here, is about 40,000. And we'll collect 50, maybe 100 cups on a good day.
Associates is one of the oldest insectaries in the world. It's been around since the early 1900s, when California farmers first realized they could use bugs to fight pests. Today, we have more and better pesticides than we did back then, but plenty of farmers still use bugs, too. Farmers like Jose Alcaraz. He manages 250 acres of citrus and avocados just down the road.
I don't want to spray too much because also you kill the beneficials. And also kill bees, also kill the insect, which is used for pollinators. So that's why we try to stay away from the spray.
But when it comes to this new pest, the Asian citrus psyllid, Alcaraz will have to spray because there's no bug on the market to fight it. That's where Mark Hoddle comes in. He's an entomologist at the University of California, Riverside. He travels the world looking for bugs. He went to Pakistan, where the psyllid comes from, and he found something big. Well, actually pretty small. It's a parasitic wasp, and it loves to eat the psyllid. So we brought a few back and started running tests to make sure they wouldn't kill other bugs, good bugs, if they came to California.
And our results were very clear. The parasites we found in Pakistan pose no risk to non-target species. They are very focused on finding Asian citrus psyllid for food.
You kind of have to wonder, wouldn't a simple spray be much easier than this? Why go to all the trouble? The answer is surprising. California has more citrus trees in people's yards than on farms. For those trees, pesticides aren't an option because they're not safe to use around lots of people. Besides, it would cost a fortune to spray every tree. And if any of those residential trees were to get citrus greening disease, all it would take would be one psyllid to carry it onto farmland, which would be very bad news.
We don't want the psyllid getting into these commercial areas because it runs the risk of introducing the disease, which will then put us on a similar trajectory to what we have seen in Florida.
That's why Mark Hoddle's wasp is so important. And he's not the only one who feels that way. The California Department of Food and Agriculture has an insectary working full-time, hatching wasps and releasing them strategically around the state. They're hoping to release 1 million by the end of the year. A big step forward in protecting California farms. For NPR News, I'm Stephen Jackson.
The town of Richwood in West Virginia once thrived on lumber and coal. As those industries fell on hard times, so did the town. Every spring, though, this struggling Appalachian community celebrates its abundance of wild ramps. Those are wild greens, sometimes known as wild leeks. The town that calls itself the world's ramp capital hosts an annual festival that locals call the Ramp Feed. Reporter Roxy Todd of Allegheny Mountain Radio attended this year's event and sent us a postcard.
The air is saturated with the smell of ramps, a pungent, garlicky, peppery smell, so strong that it eclipses almost everything in the room. There's also an aroma of bacon. The ramps have been fried in bacon grease and are served with brown beans and ham. A local songwriter, John Wyatt, is playing his Richwood ramp song for the hundreds of people waiting in line for their meal.
And the ramps begin to grow in the mountains. Then you'll know that it's springtime again.
Ramps are the first wild foods that appear in the forest each spring. The yearly tradition of eating ramps symbolizes the renewal, hope, and vigor of spring. The festival also marks a return for many Richwood natives. Dana Johnson moved to Alabama, but he comes home for the festival each spring to make sure he gets his dose of ramps.
They are considered a spring tonic. They're good for you.
Many people, like Johnson, have left Richwood to find jobs or open new businesses out of state. Since 1980, the town has lost more than 40% of its population, and a third of the remaining 2,000 or so residents are living in poverty. The ramp feed is one of the few moments in the year when this depressed small town feels like a thriving community. Out-of-towners also come to the festival, like Carrie Comiskey from East Hampton, Connecticut.
This is my first time tasting ramps and my first time to the Ramp Festival, and I plan to come back every year.
With her tanned face, Comiskey is in hiking boots as she sits with her husband and their two friends at a local restaurant. She lists the purchases that she's made at the festival, a handmade wooden table and a wooden coffee grinder, and fresh ramps, of course. She bought these from the Four Seasons Outfitters store, located along the two-lane highway into town. The owner, Bruce Donaldson, is also the largest ramp seller in Richwood. He ships about 20,000 pounds of ramps each year to buyers all over the U.S.
My men, the men that work for me, are basically laid off in the wintertime. A lot of them's in the logging industry. A lot of them transfers to coal fields, and they'll work a month. They'll be laid off. Sometimes they'll have to go 100 miles to find another job.
Like to buy some ramps?
People are camped out by the side of the road, hawking ramps that they've harvested. 11-year-old Tyler McCune is out with his stepfather and his uncles, selling the wild leeks for $4 a pound. He wears faded jeans and a navy blue t-shirt, and his blue eyes squint in the sun.
He taught me how to dig ramps. My uncle, he taught me, and my grandpa, my stepdad.
Tyler's grandfather and stepdad used to work in the sawmills. His grandfather is now disabled, and his stepdad's out of work. But they still dig ramps each spring as a family. Some people here worry that ramps are being over-harvested, and there's a debate over how much of a threat that is. Tyler McCune says his grandfather taught him how to harvest the right way, without being, as he calls it, an overpicker.
Overpickers? Yeah, they like dig every ramp they see. See, you can't do that here. I mean, you can dig a lot of ramps, but you can at least leave some roots behind, that way they'll grow. And we'll be able to keep having this good ramp feed up here in Richwood. Everybody enjoys. I enjoy it.
At the end of the one-day festival, organizers estimate the crowds have consumed about 1,700 pounds of wild ramps. The local Chamber of Commerce has raised about $3,000 to $4,000. The money will help the city remove a few of the abandoned, derelict buildings and add more art and historic photos to the vacant storefronts in downtown Richwood. For NPR News, I'm Roxy Todd.
Margaritas and guacamole became a little more expensive to make in the last few months. You can blame the squeeze on limes. Prices for limes, which were imported almost exclusively from Mexico, hit record highs this year. But now production is up, so prices are dropping. And NPR's Carrie Kahn has the story from one of Mexico's key lime-producing states.
At an outdoor market in the town of Apatzingán in the state of Michoacán, dozens of buyers hover around the backs of beat-up pickup trucks filled high with crates of limes, known in these parts as green gold. Lime buyer Geraldo Fernandez scrambles up the back of the crates and peers over the top. Fernandez says the drivers roll in and their limes are selling fast like hotcakes. While Mexico's other lime-producing states were hit hard by bad weather and a fungal outbreak, the orchards here have been flourishing, netting record profits for Michoacán's farmers. But with every boom comes the bust and prices are falling fast. Better weather and a bountiful spring crop have supplies back to normal. Fernandez thumbs through another box of limes. He tells the driver he'll give him 80 pesos, about $6, for the whole 40-pound box. Just a month or two ago, he says he was paying these guys as much as $35 a box. Prices in the U.S. are dropping, too. Last week, the USDA said consumers paid on average 30 cents a lime compared to 90 a few months ago. But Michoacan farmers aren't complaining about the precipitous price drop. Most are still enjoying their record profits and the biggest boon. This is the first time in a decade, many say, they haven't been at the mercy of Mexico's ruthless drug cartels. Down the street at a large processing plant, workers unload limes into a huge container connected to a narrow conveyor belt. As the limes move down the line, they get washed and sorted. For more than a decade, every part of the lime business was controlled by one drug gang or another, the last few by the Knights Templar cartels, says buyer and farm manager Efraín Hernández Vázquez.
Lo que ganabas te lo quitaban.
Hernandez says you'd make the money and they would take it. They charge so-called taxes, quotas on everything. The drug gang told farmers where and when they could sell their crops and, most importantly, at what price. Hernandez estimates he paid about $2,000 a week, or 10% of his sales, to the Knights Templar. But since a federal police crackdown in the state and the emergence of civilian militias, the cartel has been on the run. Several top leaders have either been killed or arrested, and three mayors and a former governor of Michoacán have been charged with colluding with organized crime. Hernandez says now it's just pure happiness. In fact, he just bought 30 more acres, and workers are clearing the land for even more limes. Hernandez tells me to take in a deep breath and smell the sweetness.
They smell so good. Well, and bien rico.
Bien sabrosos están.
The best, he says. Then he turns away from my mic and laughs. They smell just like dollars, don't they? Carrie Kahn, NPR News.
Brother bought a coconut, he bought it for the dime. His sister had another one, she paid it for the lime. She put the lime in the coconut, she drank and pulled up. She put the lime in the coconut, she drank and pulled up.
Time now for Hidden Kitchens, and today we go to Russia to peer into the kitchens of the Soviet era. In the years after the Russian Revolution of 1917, people poured into Moscow from the countryside. Housing and food were both scarce. By the 1920s, the new Soviet Union under Joseph Stalin set out to create an industrialized food system and to reimagine the role of the kitchen in Soviet society. The Kitchen Sisters, producers Davia Nelson and Nikki Silva, bring us this story of the communal kitchens of the Soviet Union.
In the time of revolution, the Stalin time, the theoretical idea of the communism declared that all people have to be equal and the women have to be freed from the slavery work in the kitchen. It mustn't be kitchen in the apartment. You will go and eat in the cafeteria. I'm Sergei Khrushchev, retired professor from Brown University. My father was Nikita Khrushchev, the head of the Soviet Union from 1953 to 1964.
The most important part of kitchen politics in early Soviet time and revolution time was they would like to have houses without kitchen. Because kitchen is something bourgeois. Every family, as long as they have a kitchen, they have some part of their private life and private property. I am Alexander Janis, Russian writer and radio journalist. The first houses that were built during the revolution, they were without kitchen. Everybody supposed to eat in huge 500 people, cafeteria, canteens.
This is part of the romantic approach of the early post-revolutionary years. My name is Masha Karp from Leningrad. I worked for the Russian service of the BBC. People forget what an incredible upheaval the 1917 revolution was. There was a huge movement to free the country from the Tsarism, bring happiness to poorer classes. People thought maybe it's a good idea to relieve a housewife from her daily chores so that she could develop as a personality. She would go and play the piano, write poetry, and she would not cook and wash up. The idea to have cafeterias was the continuation of this wonderful intention.
But it was only in theory, because after the revolution began the civil war, and they didn't build any cafeterias.
Bolsheviks were not into food. Lenin was not a foodie. They saw it as fuel to feed the workers. The Bolsheviks kind of wanted to eradicate privacy. And private hearth, private stove, becomes very politicized. I'm Anya von Bremsen. I'm the author of Mastering the Art of Soviet Cooking.
Food shortages and the famine of the 1920s devastated whatever was left of the Russian kitchen. My name is Grisha Freidin, professor of Russian literature at Stanford University. Stalin's industrialization program included the industrialization of food. Completely new food appeared, mass-produced. The whole of the Soviet Union, all 120 different ethnic groups, were suddenly being fed exactly the same stuff. Choices for this or that food, the tastings, took place at the Politburo level. The kinds of candies that began to be mass-produced was decided on a special meeting with Stalin and Molotov.
One of the goals of the new Soviet government was to provide housing to the workers. I'm Edward Chandrovich, venture investor. I'm also a Russian poet. They started putting people into communal apartments. Before, they were generally occupied by the Russian rich or aristocrats who were driven out by the new government.
I lived in the communal apartment till the age of 16, about 10 families sharing one kitchen. On one side of my room was the man who washed corpses at the local morgue. There were two rooms where mother and father served in the KGB. Then there was a woman whose husband was serving a sentence for stealing bread from the bread factory where he worked. There were two four-burner stoves. Everybody cooked their own. Cabbage soup washed with beets, potatoes, buckwheat, groats.
Five different kettles.
Boiled chicken.
Five different pots that are all marked. When the relations between the neighbors were especially fierce, you could see locks on the cabinets.
People cooked in the kitchen, but they practically never ate there. They would go with their pots along the corridor to their rooms and eat there.
Because they were communal kitchens, they were not places where you would bring your friends. I think that was one of the ideas for creating a communal kitchen. There would be a watchful eye of society over every communal apartment. People would report on each other. You would never know who would be reporting.
So even though you lived in a communal apartment in a horrible hovel and had very little to eat, there were moments when you could glimpse the future. After Stalin's death, the goal of the Soviet Union was to catch up and overtake the United States.
Vice President Nixon escorts Soviet Premier Khrushchev on a preview of the United States Fair at Skolniki Park in Moscow.
Khrushchev decided to have an exchange of exhibitions with the United States. In order to compete with the West, you had to know what it was. This was 1959. I was 13 years old. Every visitor would pass the counter where Pepsi Cola was given out in disposable paper cups that I had never seen before. They were the first American company, even before McDonald's, to get their foot in the door.
Столичная Russian vodka.
Part of the deal between Pepsi Cola and the Soviet Union was that the Pepsi Cola would be given the distribution rights for Stoli, Столичная vodka. The kitchen at the American exhibition reflected itself on the conversation between Khrushchev and Nixon, known as the kitchen debate.
American built the model of the American kitchen, and then they go to this kitchen. Nixon talk about American achievement, my father talking about Soviet achievement. They argue with each other which system is better.
Nixon and Khrushchev talk about food, how people live, how people eat.
Communal Kitchens was produced by the Kitchen Sisters with Charles Maines and mixed by Jim McKee. Next week, Hidden Kitchens returns to the Soviet Union. Under Khrushchev, the kitchen became the place to discuss and spread dissident literature and politics. Plus, you can see photos of those communal kitchens at npr.org.